Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonso reporting. The U.S. government is offering new rewards for information on the whereabouts of six leaders of the Somali militant group Al-Shabaab. A reward of up to $6 million is being offered for information on Al-Shabaab's top leader, Abu Ubaidah. He was named head of the Al-Shabaab in September of last year after the group's longtime emir, Ahmed Abe Godane, was killed in a U.S. drone strike. Rewards of up to $5 million have been authorized for three other high-ranking leaders. The U.S. continues to offer more rewards for other wanted Al-Shabaab leaders. You'll read more at voanews.com. Some 11 million children in eastern and southern Africa face hunger, disease, and water shortages as a result of the strongest El Niño weather phenomenon in decades. That's according to the United Nations Children's Fund Tuesday. Food and water shortages caused by drought and floods are causing malnutrition, which increases children's vulnerability to killer diseases like malaria, diarrhea, cholera, and dengue fever. The Egyptian military has released journalist and human rights activist Hossam Bagat a day after the United Nations and human rights group announced his detention. Egyptian authorities detained him on Sunday, accused him of spreading false news in an October report. Syrian state TV is reporting that government forces have broken a siege by the Islamic State group on the northern military air base since 2013. The report says government forces have met with troops that were defending the Quirra's air base in the northern province of Aleppo. This is VOA News. British Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond called for decisive action to combat the effects of climate change Tuesday. He spoke at the American Enterprise Institute in Washington. Hammond would join leaders in Paris on November 30th for the Global Climate Summit.
So the costs of doing nothing are potentially catastrophic beyond anything that can easily be quantified in economic terms. But even that argument would be vulnerable if the immediate cost of taking the necessary actions was economically ruinous.
Meanwhile, the White House said on Monday that President Barack Obama will press for an agreement at the Paris climate talks that reflects ambitious climate targets. After a Jordanian police officer gunned down several people at a police training facility Monday near Amman, some analysts say the killings represent a growing discontent in the region and a growing threat. VOA's Heather Murdoch reports.
The victims were two American and one South African contract trainers, a Jordanian translator and another Jordanian who was wounded in the shooting and later died in the hospital. The gunman, a Jordanian police officer, was also shot dead at the scene. Some analysts say the attacker was likely a lone wolf, unconnected to a larger terrorist organization. But Labib Kamhawi, a Jordan-based political analyst, says even if he was acting alone, the shooting reflects a growing discontent in the region.
To downplay it will not be smart, because even if the man is alone, he represents the general mood of the country.
Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Cairo.
Russia says allegations that its athletes were part of widespread doping and efforts to cover it up are groundless, and insists its policy strictly adhered to those of the Global Anti-Doping Agency and the International Olympic Committee. A Kremlin spokesman Tuesday said evidence had not been presented to substantiate the claims. U.S. prosecutors have accused three men of conducting the largest ever theft of customer data from the giant J.P. Morgan Chase Bank and other U.S. financial institutions. In an indictment unsealed in New York Tuesday, the government charged two Israelis and an American with computer hacking, wire fraud, illegal internet gambling, securities fraud, and other charges in a scheme that lasted from 2012 until a few months ago. The European Union has criticized Turkey in a report Tuesday, saying the country has shortcomings in its democratic standards and has regressed on freedoms of expression and of assembly. The report on Turkey's possible membership in the EU was held until after elections early this month that returned President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's party to a majority in parliament. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Mihi Suhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Burundi finds itself in a deep political crisis and rapid escalation of violence that has serious implications for stability and ethnic harmony in Burundi, as well as peace and security in the region.
That's UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs Jeffrey Feltman testifying before the UN Security Council. Details coming up. Also in the news, the United Nations Refugee Agency reports thousands of Malian refugees have fled into Niger in recent weeks despite the end of the conflict in Mali's north. And Slovenia says it will join several other EU nations in building a fence to stem the flow of migrants and refugees. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Angola, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, top UN officials have warned that Burundi is in the grip of a deep political crisis with violence that has left hundreds dead and many thousands displaced. The violence began last April when President Pierre Nkurunziza announced he would seek a third term, which the opposition called unconstitutional. Among those testifying before the UN Security Council yesterday was Jeffrey Feltman, Undersecretary General for Political Affairs.
Burundi finds itself in a deep political crisis and rapid escalation of violence that has serious implications for stability and ethnic harmony in Burundi, as well as peace and security in the region. The political, economic, social, and security gains that came out of the landmark Arusha agreement are already at risk. The May 22nd killing of Zaidi Feruzi, a key opposition figure, marked the beginning of a troubling pattern of politically motivated assassinations and attacks. Neither the conclusion of Burundi's legislative and presidential electoral cycle this summer, nor the inclusion of some key opposition figures in the governing coalition calmed the situation, which has instead grown more troubling.
Felton said the situation in the capital, Bujumbura, remains very tense.
Several neighborhoods, especially those perceived to have opposed President Nkurunziza's third term, experienced nightly exchanges of gunshots and grenade explosions. Traumatized residents frequently discover mutilated bodies, victims of executions.
The Undersecretary General also warned of hate speech.
In this very tense environment, inflammatory and chilling public statements from authorities have provoked concern and alarm in Burundi, the region, and beyond. In a 29 October speech, the president of the Senate, Reverend Dicario, told local administrators to be ready and set their emotions aside if a signal is given to the police to, quote, go to work, which has been widely interpreted as implying a pre-planned operation. He also said that, quote, plots of land are about to be available. On 2nd November, President Nkurunziza gave armed civilians 5 days to surrender their arms or face being dealt with as, quote, enemies of the nation. The president said that the police have the right to use, quote, all available means to find illegally possessed arms. While police forces do have the right and the responsibility to maintain law and order, many incidents described as crackdown activities appear to cross the line into extrajudiciary attacks, striking fear among the residents of some neighborhoods. Consequently, we have received reports that the president's ultimatum has prompted a large number of people living in affected neighborhoods to flee their homes ahead of the deadline this past weekend. Many recent statements have also been interpreted as having an ethnic dimension contrary to the spirit of the Arusha Agreement that ended Burundi's civil war.
Also testifying before the Security Council was UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Zaid Ra'ad Al Hussein.
I regret to report my deepening concern regarding the increasingly grave human rights crisis in Burundi. In addition to the rising death toll, I must alert this council to warning signs of further escalation, including potentially very serious regional repercussions. The country is at another crucial and extremely dangerous tipping point, and I believe that member states and this council can intervene effectively to prevent the repetition of past horrors. Within Burundi, and particularly Bujumbura, there have been increasing numbers of extrajudicial killings documented in recent months, including multiple alleged political assassinations. At least 240 people have been killed since protests began in April, with bodies dumped on the streets on almost a nightly basis. There have been hundreds of cases of arbitrary arrest and detention in the past month alone, targeting members of the opposition, journalists, human rights defenders and their families, people attending the funerals of those who have been killed, and inhabitants of neighborhoods perceived to be supportive of the opposition.
He said Burundians who disagree with the government live with intense fear.
The abduction and murder just 3 days ago of 25-year-old William Nzitonda, son of a well-known human rights defender, Pierre Claver Bonimpa, is one very recent and painful example. Mr. Bonimpa was himself badly wounded during an attempt on his life in August, and his son-in-law, another human rights defender, was killed last month. Many credible allegations of torture have been documented, notably at a locality in Bujumbura run by the SNR Intelligence Service. Violations have also been reported on the part of National Police and by the heavily armed API police unit that was created in September to fight against acts of terrorism, in quotes. The Imbonerakure militia associated with the ruling party continues to terrorize the population, sometimes in collaboration with the police, and perpetrates human rights abuses with total impunity. Specific neighborhoods have been locked down by police with reports of gun battles. Unidentified but apparently well-armed and organized individuals opposed to the government are also committing killings.
The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights said more than 280,000 Burundians have been displaced, with many fleeing to neighboring countries. He also said it's been reported that armed groups are recruiting in some refugee camps and that agents of the Burundi government are present to identify opponents. However, despite the testimony by UN officials, Burundi's foreign minister told the Security Council that Burundi is not in flames. Alain Amine Amitawe dismissed warnings that his country was on the verge of a Rwanda-like genocide. Meanwhile, France is circulating a Security Council draft resolution to impose sanctions. Also, the U.S. Special Envoy to the Great Lakes, Thomas Perriello, says it is crucial for all parties in Burundi to respect their commitments to an internationally mediated dialogue with no preconditions, without delay. He says this is the only viable way to return Burundi to the path of peace and prosperity. Meanwhile, the human rights group Amnesty International is calling for UN and regional action to end violence and political turmoil in Burundi. Sarah Jackson is Amnesty's Deputy Regional Director for East Africa, the Horn and the Great Lakes regions. From Nairobi, she spoke to VOA's Jody Kapawa about the crisis in Burundi.
Well, killings in Burundi have continued unabated in recent weeks. Bodies are being found in the streets on a daily basis. And we've seen in the last week an increase in inflammatory language by government officials. So the situation in Burundi is getting worse and has the potential to spiral into outright crisis.
What can be done to stop it?
Well, regional actors are taking the lead on the mediation. The East African community, under the leadership of President Museveni, is expected to mediate in this crisis. But so far we've seen the mediation has reached a stalemate. It's absolutely essential now that the mediation is restarted so that there's a dialogue and a political solution to this political crisis. The African Union has been very strong in their words in October, calling for dialogue, threatening targeted sanctions, calling for human rights observers to be placed on the ground. It's now essential that these words turn into action.
You mentioned sanctions. I believe France is currently circulating a draft resolution before the UN Security Council calling for sanctions. Do you feel sanctions are necessary now?
We think that sanctions could be, if they're targeted against specific individuals who have a responsibility for this crisis, could be one useful tool to encourage dialogue, to deter human rights abuses, and ultimately to try and resolve this situation.
You're also calling for independent human rights observers to be allowed in, and also the protection of residents from further violence. Do you feel that the independent human rights observers would be safe going to Burundi?
Right now, it's just so important to have more eyes and ears on the ground, more people witnessing what is happening, so that one day there can be accountability for this and to dissuade actors from further human rights violations. We hope that the situation is such that the African Union can safely deploy human rights observers on the ground now and increase in number those that they have there already.
Do you think African Union troops are needed to keep the peace in Burundi?
We're not currently calling for the deployment of the African Union troops, but we understand that discussions are ongoing regarding a possible contingency force if mass atrocities were to occur.
A number of people, including Rwandan President Paul Kagame, have warned that Burundi may be on the verge of a Rwanda-like genocide that occurred in the 1990s. Do you feel Burundi is on the verge of such violence?
At the moment, what we're seeing is political violence, politically targeted killings. With the government's deadline for the end of disarmament in so-called opposition neighborhoods and the inflammatory rhetoric by government officials over recent days, we are concerned about the potential for mass violence on political lines.
Sarah Jackson is Amnesty's Deputy Regional Director for East Africa, the Horn and the Great Lakes region. From Nairobi, she spoke to VOA's Jordi Kapua. The United Nations Refugee Agency reports thousands of Malian refugees have fled into Niger in recent weeks, despite the end of the conflict in Mali's north. The UNHCR says this is the highest flow of refugees since a peace accord between government and Tuareg rebels was signed in June. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The conflict in Mali erupted in early 2012. French and African troops intervened and retook much of the north from al-Qaeda-linked militants in early 2013. But the government only signed a peace deal with separatist Tuareg rebels and other armed groups in the north this June. Early this year, the UNHCR reported about 47,500 Malian refugees were registered in Niger. But agency spokesman Lou Dobbs says a projected peace dividend of the refugees returning home and other Malians staying put has not happened. Indeed, he says some 4,000 Malians have crossed into Niger from Mali's sparsely populated east since the start of October.
Those arriving in Niger say they are fleeing because of lawlessness, extortion, food shortages, intertribal rivalry, fighting between herders and farmers, and a power vacuum in the absence of a strong government and military presence in the east.
Dobbs says the majority of the new arrivals come from rural areas. Female refugees tell aid workers they fled because their animals had been stolen. They said their children could not go to school and public infrastructure had been damaged because national authorities were not there to safeguard them. He tells VOA this is a very disturbing and unexpected development. He says it appears as though the Malian refugees are making plans to remain in Niger for a long time.
We've seen people, mainly Tuaregs, who've been moving out of tents and into constructing mud houses. So people seem to be looking to the future in Niger, which means they'll continue to need help.
Dobbs says the new influx and unprecedented numbers of Malian refugees is putting a strain on the UNHCR operation in Niger at a time when its budget is being reduced. He says the emergency phase of the operation is over and funds for next year are to be cut in half, from $300 per capita to $150 per capita. Unfortunately, he notes, this will not be enough to deal with the latest and possibly future influx of Malian refugees into Niger. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You are listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Slovenia says it will join several other EU nations in building a fence to stem the flow of migrants and refugees. It was once a strong critique of building such barriers. The fence is planned for Slovenia's border with Croatia. The country's prime minister says about 30,000 migrants are on their way to his country. He says many may be stranded in Slovenia if neighboring Austria restricts the flow of people. The official warns of a possible humanitarian catastrophe. German Chancellor Angela Merkel says Slovenia's action shows that a common European solution to the migrant and refugee crisis is urgently needed. A high-ranking UN official says Boko Haram violence in the Lake Chad region could send vast numbers of people to join the migration north to Europe. Tony Lanzer is the UN coordinator for the Sahel. He noted to Reuters that efforts to expel the terrorist group from Nigeria has driven them towards the Lake Chad region, where millions have left their homes. Lanzer said other factors were contributing to violence and displacement, including poverty, environmental degradation, and lack of job opportunities. He said the area is ripe for Boko Haram recruitment, given the vast number of young people living around Lake Chad. Lanzer made his comment ahead of an EU-Africa summit on migration in Malta today. Reuters says the EU is expected to announce a nearly $2 billion trust fund to tackle the root causes of irregular migration and forced displacement in Africa. The Lagos Vanguard says a European Union official in Abuja on Monday noted that 7,436 Nigerians crossed into Europe from Nigeria. The official said the figures come from the EU border agency called Frontex. Today, Nigeria's military government executed environmental activist Ken Saro-Wiwa for his campaign against oil giant Shell. VOA's Christine spoke with his son, Ken Saro-Wiwa Jr., and has this report.
Ken Saro-Wiwa led a campaign in the 1990s that got oil company Shell to pull out of the Ogoniland region of the Niger Delta. Communities there said the multinational was polluting their land and fishing waters, accusations that have since been validated by the UN Environment Program. UNEP said in a 2011 report that the pollution could take as many as 30 years to clean up. Shell says it remains committed to cleanup efforts, though Amnesty International and other advocacy groups said this month that those efforts had been insufficient. The execution of Saro-Wiwa and eight other Ogoniland activists in 1995 was widely seen as retaliation for their activism. The pollution and poverty in the Niger Delta sparked a violent insurgency that only ended in 2009, when the government started paying militants off as part of an amnesty agreement. Those payments reduce the violence, but people still sabotage pipelines, and it is unclear if the amnesty payments will continue beyond this year. Sarawiwa's son, Ken Sarawiwa Jr., who worked in the administration of former President Goodluck Jonathan, thinks that the insurgency could have been avoided had the military government responded differently to the community grievances raised by his father.
If it had been dealt with dialogue back then rather than violence, we might have a more secure outcome than we have now.
Even in the democratic Nigeria of today, Sarawiwa remains a touchy subject. A memorial to Sarawiwa in the shape of a bus that was being shipped to Nigeria for the anniversary was denied entry, sparking outrage. But Sarawiwa Jr. says that's a distraction.
You know, federal government, Shell, and the communities are working hard to try to arrive at a place where we can begin to earnestly implement the UNEP report. And it would have been nice to have on the 20th anniversary to be focusing on that rather than the bus.
The best way to honor his father's legacy, Sarawiwa Jr. says, is to clean up Ogoniland. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
East Africa is bracing for the impact of El Nino. In Uganda, the government is preparing for massive flooding and landslides and already dealing with a cholera outbreak. People living in slum areas are at high risk. Elizabeth Polat reports from Kampala.
Uganda is experiencing some of its most volatile weather in 20 years. This is due to El Nino, a global climate phenomenon that occurs when surface temperatures in the Pacific Ocean warm and redirect usual wind patterns. Godfrey Majuni, a manager at Uganda's Meteorological Data Center, says rains will continue through what should be the dry season.
Of course, our analysis was based on the evolution of El Nino, and we are still monitoring this El Nino because it has not decayed at all. It is still there. If El Nino continues to be strong, then we expect a wet January and February, which are always dry months here in Uganda. Whereas in other areas, of course, El Nino is associated with, you know, warm and dry conditions. But here in East Africa, El Nino is associated with enhanced rainfall.
Heavy rains have already led to a cholera outbreak that has killed 6 people in western Uganda. And residents in rural mountainous areas prone to mudslides have been asked to vacate their homes. Large rain-induced mudslides in these areas in 2010 and 2012 left hundreds of people dead or missing. In Kampala, a number of wetland systems around the city are responsible for drainage during periods of increased rainfall. However, both legal and illegal construction have impeded the flow of water. A recent report by the World Bank blames weak regulatory control for the deterioration of the wetlands, saying lack of oversight has left Kampala's residents at risk. Peter Kaju, a spokesman with the Kampala Capital City Authority, says they are working to combat this problem.
The major challenge still exists, you know, people dumping in drainage channels, and at the end of the day they are clogged, so there's no smooth flow of water. But we have carried out mass sensitization in these communities, and we go to them, we share with them, we tell them what the repercussions are. These are some of the activities that actually stand in the way of water flow, storm water flow.
He says they have also raised some structures in wetland areas and along drainage channels. Uganda has increased disaster management teams both in Kampala and around the country. Yet with rainfall expected to increase in coming months, even preventative measures could leave some of the nation's poorest residents with nowhere to go. Elizabeth Pola for VOA News, Kampala.
This is African News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Swuhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni is facing his toughest challenge yet. Join host Shaka Sali and his guests as they explore the possibility of major opposition leaders, former Prime Minister Amama Mbabazi and Dr. Kizza Besigye, joining forces in next year's Ugandan poll. That's next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC on VOA Africa.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joba.
Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.
This is African News Tonight on The Voice of America, and here is a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Top UN officials have warned that Burundi is in the grip of a deep political crisis. And the United Nations Refugee Agency reports thousands of Malian refugees have fled into Niger in recent weeks, despite the end of conflict in Mali's north. Coming up, music from Angola, and in our feature segment, the African migration to Europe. I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is African News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Hello, Sunny.
Good evening, Yehiz.
Sunny, I understand you're kicking off with African football.
Yehiz, it's a big week in African football. 40 national teams will play first-leg fixtures in the qualifying competition for the 2018 World Cup in Russia. And by next Tuesday, November 17th, when the final second-leg matches are played, only 20 African teams will remain in the running for one of those much-coveted tickets to the 2018 World Cup. Remember, VOA World Cup fans, all of these upcoming African qualifiers are home and away series. The winners are determined by tallying the goals in the two games. The action will kick off Wednesday with matches in Maputo, Mozambique, and Karima, Sudan. In Maputo, Mozambique is matched against Gabon, and in Karima, about 400 kilometers northwest of the capital, Khartoum, Sudan will play Zambia. Both World Cup qualifiers are scheduled to begin at 1700 UTC on Wednesday. Now, in terms of World Cup pedigrees, Mozambique, Gabon, Sudan, and Zambia have never qualified for football's premier event. Sudan and Zambia each have captured a continental title, though. The Sudanese won the Africa Cup of Nations tournament in 1970, and the Zambians won the competition in 2012. Our African football guru, David Legg, is looking forward to this week's 2018 World Cup qualifiers. But David is also looking forward to the FIFA presidential election, the subject of our chat this evening. Sporty greetings, David.
Thank you, Sammy.
Off the pitch, David, two Africans, Musa Beliti from Liberia and Tokyo Sekwale from South Africa, officially in the running for president of FIFA, World Football's governing body. The election scheduled for February 26th in Zurich, Switzerland. What's your take, David? Do you think ultimately Africa will put forth only one candidate?
Definitely, Sonny. That's our only hope of success. It's got to be one candidate. And I think, no bias, it's going to be the South African Tokyo Sekwale. Although, significantly at this stage, Sonny, he has not yet been endorsed by CAF. Now, CAF, the biggest confederation, they've got 54 members. In fact, I got in touch with FIFA just to make sure I got all my figures correct. I've had a lot of emails asking me which confederations have got so many votes. Well, here we go. Asia's got 46 votes. Africa's got 54. That's the highest. CONCACAF, that's North and Central America and the Caribbean, they've got 35 votes, so a not insignificant number. CONMEBOL, that's South America, they've got 10 votes. Oceania have got 11, and Europe have got 53. And when you add all those figures up, Sonny, you come to 209. Another theme of a number of emails I've received is, how does the voting actually work? How do you win the vote to become FIFA president? Well, Sonny, in the first round, irrespective of how many candidates survive, and I'm guessing it will probably be about three of those seven, you need 140 votes. If you get that number of votes in the first round, you win. The show is over there and then. But what I think is far more likely to happen is it's going to be a gradual process and that nobody will get that magical figure first time round. What happens then, Sonny, is the person with the least number of votes is eliminated round by round. So the person with the lowest total drops out. And ultimately, what you need is 105 votes. That is just over half the 209, so 105. So if you want to win outright at the start, you get 140 votes. Otherwise, you eventually, when things get whittled down to the eventual two challengers, 105 votes will get you through. Clearly, everybody wants those African votes, Sonny, because within hours of the confirmation of those seven candidates, Al Khalifa from Asia, Al Hussein from Asia, Infantino, one of the UEFA candidates, and Tokyo Sakali, that's four of the seven candidates, had all flown to Cairo to rub shoulders and no doubt make their cases to the African Football Confederation and its president, Issa Hayatou. For Sakali to have any chance, Sonny, he has got to be endorsed by CAF. He, in fact, needs as many as possible of those 54 votes to have a realistic chance. You assume that Asia will go, I believe, strongly towards Al Khalifa. And UEFA, if Michel Platini drops out because of this suspension issue, Infantino will surely be able to count on the majority there. And they, to me, Sonny, ultimately could be the big three, so to speak. It could be Tokyo Sakwali with the backing of Africa, Infantino or Platini being backed by Europe, and Asia supporting Al Khalifa. Sonny, I'm not going any further than that at this stage. It's too early. But obviously, we've all got our fingers crossed here in Africa that Tokyo Sakwali will become the first African president of FIFA. But boy, it's going to be tough, because even if he was to get all 54 CAF votes, he still has to find another 51. So he's going to be clocking up those air miles, and I suspect a fair amount of that time will be spent in Central America and also in the Caribbean and perhaps also in Oceania. He has to woo people beyond the borders of Africa, otherwise he cannot succeed. Fascinating battle coming up, Sonny. Sometimes you feel that these football politics can be more exciting than watching the games themselves.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa. In African youth football, Mali and world champion Nigeria have won some big awards at the FIFA Under-17 World Cup in Chile, as we hear now from our Daybreak Africa sportsman, Mark Ouma.
Nigeria Golden Eaglets captain Kelechi Nwankwo is the Adidas Golden Ball Award winner at the just-concluded FIFA Under-17 World Cup, FIFA revealed. The midfielder received the award for the tournament's best player. Nigerian striker Victor Osimhen received the Adidas Silver Ball Award for scoring the most goals at the tournament. He scored 10 goals, which is a new tournament record. Mali, who lost to Nigeria 2-0 in the final and are African Under-17 champions, had also something to cheer. Industrious attacking midfielder Ali Male received the Adidas Bronze Ball Award. However, Mali's biggest accolade for an individual player went to goalkeeper Samuel Diarra, who received the Adidas Golden Glove Award for being the tournament's best custodian. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization, WHO, has declared Sierra Leone free of the deadly Ebola virus, WHO revealed in Geneva, Switzerland. Consequently, Sierra Leone can now once again organize football matches. The Confederation of African Football banned the playing of football in the Mano River region, which includes Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone, in August last year. This was aimed at preventing the spread of the Ebola virus. As a result, Sierra Leone hosted their home fixtures in Morocco, Cameroon, and Nigeria. Now, Sierra Leone can stage their first international match at home since they hosted Seychelles in Freetown in July last year in an Africa Cup of Nations qualifier. The WHO says Sierra Leone now enters a 90-day period of enhanced surveillance.
Thanks, Mark. That's Mark Ouma of our Daybreak Africa radio show. which you can tune in Monday through Friday on The Voice of America. If you tuned in to Monday's Sunny Side of Sports, you heard Douglas Mpuga lead off the show with a report on Russia being implicated in a widespread doping program in world athletics. The Russian sports minister, Vitaly Mutko, says the allegations made against his country by the World Anti-Doping Agency, or WADA, are not supported by evidence. The WADA report concludes by saying Russia should be banned from competing in athletics. Reporter Henry Ridgewell has more details for us from London.
From the peaceful surroundings of Geneva, the World Anti-Doping Agency set off a new earthquake to shake the foundations of global sport. Accusations that Russia has for years been conducting a state-supported doping program in athletics. Dick Pound is head of the commission looking into the allegations.
We have found cover-ups, we found destruction of samples in the laboratories, we found payments of money in order to conceal doping tests, among others.
Pound said the Russian State Security Service, the FSB, was present at anti-doping laboratories, part of a wider pattern of direct intimidation and interference by the Russian state. The commission called on Russia to be banned from athletics competition.
The outcome may be that there are no Russian track and field athletes in Rio. I hope that they get they recognize that it's time to change and make those changes.
Moscow's Minister for Sport strongly denied the allegations. Russia finished second in the London 2012 Olympics medal table behind the United States. Pound said the event had been sabotaged by the laissez-faire attitude taken by the International Association of Athletics Federations, or IAAF. The newly elected head of that body, Sebastian Coe, vowed Monday to clean up the sport, but admitted it would be a long road.
I've asked my council to convene on Friday this week. We will review what they have said. And then we will look at the next steps, which could include sanctions.
The IAAF Council has 27 members, most of them famous names, who now hold Russia's fate in their hands, says sports historian Philip Barker.
These people are big figures in athletics, and they have been charged with looking at what they're going to do, what their response would be.
Barker added that when Coe was asked would he ban Russia, the IAAF head said never say never. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Thanks, Henry. As we heard in Henry's report, the IAAF Council will meet on Friday to discuss the Russia case. Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny, and my Twitter handle is @VOA Sunny Sports. I'm VOA Sunny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yehaeus Wuhee.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Friday, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 17:30 UTC right here on The Voice of America. Coming up, the African migration to Europe. And next, tuberculosis. Now, the world's leading infectious killer, topping HIV/AIDS. But first, some music. Here is Danielle from Angola with Amatumba.
Isso não lhe caiu, não sei pro que insiste. Estilo do bem marado, mas até moça resiste. Boca, estilo surra, cara enfeitada tipo elele. Chega na disco, gingona, todos fogem da negra bué.
Desculpa, menina, se ofendo, mas é demais, não tem jeito. Dá-lhe, vai! Lá vem ela, a macumba. Bunda, venha, bunda, tunda. Corpo é corpo, é imbondeiro, é. Não aguento, não tem jeito. Olha só o espaço que ocupa no carro da outra. Tipo candongueiro bem cheio na hora de ponta. Nem racha um bumbo para abastecer na bomba.
Agarrado, mulher,
que chega bem rápido para cair na quizamba. Agarra a matumba,
chama a polícia.
Para a matumba,
chama a polícia.
Acalma a matumba, que era quizumba. Agarra a matumba, agarra a matumba,
chama a polícia.
Para a matumba,
chama a polícia.
Acalma a matumba, que era quizumba. Agarra a matumba. Bife do Rio de Janeiro, mas mesmo assim não tem jeito. Dente, luta contra dente, que uso é de ferro. Galina, dá licença, tenta chegar no sapato. Pois mudou o penteado, aterrando um afro marado. Lá vem ela,
a malaica,
candongueira,
a xaxeira.
Sete agarra, parte esqueleto. Desculpa, menina, se ofendo, mas o retrato é verdadeiro.
Ela te quer, o que que ela quer? Ela te quer, vai fazer o quê? Eu não lhe quero, vai fazer o quê? Eu não lhe quero, é melhor lhe dar pra te ensinar. Agora ou nunca, é melhor lhe dar pra te ensinar. Agora ou nunca,
não vale a pena de cas malaicas de nainita. Se ela não lhe quero, se ela lhe quero, ele não quer.
Tu ama tu.
Não vale a pena vir ofender. Você só se coça com quem quero. Ela te quero, você não quer.
Tunda, matumba.
Mas aquele jeito de vestir mal continua. Mas aquele jeito de vestir mal continua. Mas aquele jeito de vestir mal continua. Comprei no estrangeiro, mas continua matumba. Coça, coça.
É de se coçar, é.
Ninguém aqui vai se atrapalhar. Daniel chegou para te animar. Mania fez esta batida. Que me cuia,
tá me cuia.
Se não tem troma que tua. Quem não dançou, manda ele em vida. Quem gostou, vai ficar. Vamos continuar até coçar, che.
Olha já como tá doce. Olha já como tá doce. Olha já como tá doce. Tá doce, tá doce. Olha já como tá doce. Olha já como tá doce. Olha já como tá doce. Tá doce, tá doce.
2005. Os matumbo tão tipo salelê na madeira.
Remix. Cuidado com este meu quiabo. Você me vê tirar voado. Fica maiado com este som. Bate frita tipo bacon. Nossa batida é muito chique. Tipo GT7 na SIC. Quer se matar?
Se mata.
Remexa a bunda. Sucesso até na sanzala. Na disco, na cama e na sala. Você fala mal, não me cala. Olha mal, mas não me atrapalha. Vida de não é problema. Todo mundo entra no esquema. Vira do lado, vira do outro. Remexa a bunda.
Danielle from Angola with Amatumba. Hundreds have died trying to cross the Mediterranean to Europe in recent months. Somalis, Eritreans and Sudanese are among them. Members of the U.S. Congress are concerned. VOA's Esther Gitwe interviewed U.S. Congresswoman Karen Bass and reports from Washington, D.C.
Touched by how many Africans continue to lose their lives, U.S. Congresswoman Karen Bass, who is a ranking member of the Africa Subcommittee, organized a discussion to specifically address the African migration problem. And in an exclusive interview with Africa 54, She said the U.S. needs to increase the number of African refugees admitted in the country.
What sparked my concern is that the attention has shifted. A year or so ago, everybody was focused on Africans. There was that one boat accident, a horrific accident, in which 800 migrants died. And since then, the issue has been about Syria, and I think the significance of African refugees has kind of slipped off the agenda.
I asked Congresswoman Karen Bass what she personally thought was the root cause of so many Africans leaving their countries and risking their lives in the high seas.
The situation, for example, of Eritreans leaving is one thing, but when Libya fell, certainly a lot of the sub-Saharan Africans that were in Libya were mistreated. They left for different reasons. So I think it's really important that we not paint it with one brush. We look at people leaving each country in a different manner for those specific root causes. And we certainly know that some people are leaving out of economic desperation.
She says most of the Africans are fleeing persecution, ungovernable situations and instability that exists in several places. But what does the Congresswoman think should be the role of the African Union in addressing the crisis?
I actually think the African Union and the United States and United Nations are addressing the crisis, but it's really important to hear specifically what they are doing. And as the Syrian crisis has reached such extreme proportions, with 50% of the country's population displaced, which is incredible, I don't want that to overshadow the specific situations that are facing African countries.
Congresswoman Bass says that even though she has confidence policymakers are taking the crisis seriously, there's a need to examine the role of the United States to say exactly what the U.S. is doing, not just in bringing refugees into the country, but also addressing the root causes of why people are leaving their countries.
I have full confidence that the policymakers are taking it seriously. But what I want to hear out of this policy conference, what are the numbers? Where are the Africans?
The United States this year admitted 25,000 African refugees, but there's a call for the U.S. to increase that number and do more to tackle the refugee crisis.
That was U.S. Congresswoman Karen Bass talking to VOA's Esther Gitwee about the African migration to Europe. Tuberculosis. A World Health Organization says tuberculosis is now the world's leading infectious killer, topping HIV/AIDS. VOA's Carl Pearson reports that WHO says we need more aggressive efforts to curb the epidemic.
Tuberculosis is an infectious disease that mainly affects the poor, and those who have it are often stigmatized. The World Health Organization considers TB an epidemic. WHO is looking for an infusion of close to $3 billion for research into new drugs, new diagnostic tools, and better surveillance so those with the disease can be treated. Since 1990, the death rate from TB has fallen by nearly 50%, but the WHO says more progress must be made.
You cannot accept 4,400 people dying every day of a curable disease.
Tuberculosis is 90% curable, unless it's a strain that is multi-drug resistant. Only about half of the people who suffer from that strain survive. Some doctors compare it to the deadly Ebola virus, only more easily transmitted.
Multi-drug resistant tuberculosis, MDR-TB, is like Ebola with wings, because it has the same risk of transmission to other people. It can be transmitted even just by coughing in the air, in the train, in the church, in a bar, in a hospital. So it's a serious threat.
Starting in January of 2016, the WHO will launch an effort to end TB. Those involved in this effort believe it can happen.
That 47% drop in deaths from TB is from hard work. It didn't just kind of happen. And what it has told us is that indeed hard work does reflect itself in a drop in new infections, and we need to do more in more places and sustain that effort everywhere.
Goosby says the world is beginning to understand the severity of the TB threat. As it does, the WHO hopes support for efforts to end the disease will increase. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
This Here's Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The death of a mother is the greatest misfortune for a young family. When a woman dies in childbirth, the newborn's own chances of survival diminish tenfold. That child and any siblings are less likely to receive health care and to go to school, and the family as a whole is now more likely to suffer economic hardship. Yet every 2 minutes, another mother dies during pregnancy or childbirth. More than half of the deaths occur in sub-Saharan Africa. That is why in June 2012, the United States and the government of Norway partnered with the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, the private sector initiative Merck for Mothers, and the Every Mother Counts campaign to found the Saving Mothers Giving Life initiative. Saving Mothers Giving Life is a 5-year initiative that seeks to reduce maternal mortality by half and improve health in places where women are dying at alarming rates during pregnancy and childbirth. It was initially implemented in 4 districts each in Uganda and Zambia, with a focus on labor, delivery, and the first 48 hours postpartum, the time period in which some 2/3 of maternal deaths and nearly half of infant deaths occur. Early reports indicated that the program was working, so it was expanded in 2014 to an additional 12 districts in Zambia and another 6 districts in Uganda. Now the program has reached its halfway point, and the results are astonishingly good. In Uganda, the institutional maternal mortality rate has fallen by 45% since the beginning of the initiative, and thanks to a strong training and educational campaign, by 41% at the community level. In Zambia, institutional mortality, meaning in a hospital or clinic, has fallen by 53% in the target districts, and nearly 90% of women are now giving birth in a facility compared to 63% at the outset of the initiative. As a result of this success, the partnership is expanding the program to Nigeria, a country that accounts for 14% of the world's maternal deaths and a quarter of the world's newborn deaths, with an initial focus on the southeastern state of Cross River. Surviving childbirth should not be a matter of luck or where you live or how much money you have. Together, we are working to make that a reality.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bunganyi in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Employment rates are climbing, so definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Malaria kills thousands of people each year, but there are some simple things you can do to protect your family. If you can, put screens in your windows. A simple screen can keep disease-carrying mosquitoes out of your home. If you go outside, wear light-colored clothing and long pants and long sleeves, especially when it is dark and mosquitoes are most active. After it rains, empty all containers of standing water. The water in just one discarded tire can become a breeding ground for thousands of mosquitoes. Make sure your home is clear of debris and anything that holds water, including discarded cans, water containers, and rubbish. Empty containers that livestock drink from regularly so that mosquitoes cannot breed there.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.